Welcome to the Quintessential Listening Poetry Online Radio and YouTube Podcast, streamed live from the heart of Washington, D.C. Here, you'll find a portal to vibrant voices, echoing souls, and an ongoing celebration of the extraordinary power of language. So, prepare yourself to join host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram and his special guests as they explore traditional and spoken word forms of poetry.
Tonight, my special guest is poet, novelist, playwright, a cappella vocalist, Stacy Artis Dyson. In her much lauded work, Stacy explores and illuminates the life and times of the Black woman. She's released 6 chapbooks, 5 CDs, and performed and or led workshops all over the country. Following her last collections, Lovely and the Suffering, and Follow Me on This, she's working on a new collection called Because the Sun Would Not Move. Help me welcome the acclaimed Stacy Artis Dyson to the program. Hello, Stacy.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I've been waiting for this.
Wonderful. Let's begin this poetic journey. What is poetry?
It all very much depends on who you're talking to. For me, it's a combination of blood rhythm and life experience. It's internal. The first thing anybody hears, everybody hears, in one way or another, is music and poetry. Nursery rhymes and lullabies are music and poetry. But as I say, blood rhythm, I think you're born with the recognition of that sound and that, for lack of a better phrase, passion of necessity in your bones. It's always there, the DNA. The only difference between poets and civilians as such is that we just decide to do something about it, but it's in everybody. That the rhythm that poetry amplifies, carries, illustrates, illuminates, that life necessity that has to be there in life. I certainly cannot breathe without it. And I don't actually know a whole lot of people, whether they realize it or not, who can. Poetry comes in so many different ways, and it's not always verbal. It can be something that moves you, something you hear, something that you put your hands on.
There are some who believe that poetry is dying. What is your take on it? Is poetry still important?
I firmly believe that it is. It will be completely stamped out in about 9-10 billion years. Okay, we won't have any need for it. As soon as the earth explodes and life forms everywhere no longer exist, then yeah, poetry will be out of here. So it's only been around since before the dawn of time. It'll be leaving after the last asteroid blows up. So this is the Johnny come lately we're talking about.
All right.
So quite seriously, there is no way this will never happen. Because as I say, it's internal. It's blood rhythm. Blood rhythm isn't going anywhere. So poetry isn't either.
Is it important?
It is crucial. Because people have to be able to tell their truth. And poetry is the most, to me, effective and efficient way of doing that. Other art forms, dance and painting and all of that, all of those things that are expression of what your body can do or what acting is, you're out there and you're communicating. It's all communication, but poetry is the most intense communication. this is coming out of your heart and your soul and being given, actually, to people that you might not ever see in life, might not ever know about. So I'm not going to say it's the most important art form. I don't believe in competition, first of all. They're all important, but this one, to me, is the one that says the most about who we are and where we're going, because these are 1,000 hearts singing individual truth. And that's important. That individuality of voice is important. That putting it out there, bleeding in front of a crowd, that's important. That's crucial. Because if you don't have that, then you start losing humanity because it doesn't seem real anymore.
Here's a question that I rarely ever ask. I'm wondering, do you live your life like it's a poem?
I live my life like a poet. That's something completely different. I live my life doing my best to tell my truth and get it out in front of other people. Whatever form that takes, and it has taken a couple of really interesting forms, I'm not going to be so arrogant as to say I live my life like a poem. I will say that I live it according to my mission statement.
Stacy, please share with us an early experience where you learned that poetic language had power.
Oh, gosh. There have been so many of those where I found out that poetic language had power. And it's really hard for me to say this experience or that time. You and I were talking a little bit before we hit the camera about poetry and music being the same thing. And so I can tell you that when I was a little girl, I think 3 or 4. And I remember standing in the hallway singing the Beatles, "It's Been a Hard Day's Night," to my parents' company, and just seeing people just enthralled at this. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say the magnificence of my voice. First of all, I was 3 years old. But the idea that, hey, you can get people to listen when you do this, when you're doing it from your heart, everything, you know, has to be from your heart, even at 3. Like, 3-year-olds don't know how to do anything else. It's all out there. The interesting thing about doing that and then later doing poetry was it never crossed my mind that I was doing something that everybody in the world could do. I thought everybody did this. For the longest, when I went to school, I was shocked to find out that not everybody sang and wrote poetry. I still don't understand that. But the idea that this fantastic vehicle for getting your voice out there and for getting other people to come to you and listen to what you were saying, not necessarily understand, that's the grand hope. But at least they're to listen to what it is that you're saying and to listen to them appreciate you putting your heart and soul and everything else out there. I thought everybody did that. I'm 65 now. I'm still really shocked that they don't.
So with that information, learning so much at an early age, the power of words, language, poetry, how did that shape you?
On a very basic level, I just wanted to keep doing more of it. When you're little, you want attention.
Yes.
Got your attention. Okay. Which is really interesting because I'm an introvert. And this is the only thing that the artistic thing, that's what I want attention for. My other blunder, not so much. But the way it shaped me was the older I got, the more I recognized that too many people hide. We all, I want to say, is it Dunbar or Weldon? I cannot remember, and I should be shocked for this. We wear the mask. And everybody does that, and some of us, for one reason or another, are forced to do it more than others, and in different ways, but everybody has that mask. And it's always bothered me that people just can't say what it is they need to say, or don't. While I understand that some people don't have the courage to, it really bothers me that they don't. I certainly understand that there are people who cannot, because in certain countries, as we know, they will be killed for speaking their mind, especially if they're women. I understand all that. It hurts my heart that not everybody can or will do this, can or cannot or will not say what it is that they need to say, get their ideas out there. I hate that.
People are often afraid that something will happen, and it makes them very vulnerable, I believe.
And the thing about it is that vulnerability is part of what creates, maintains, makes necessary this art form.
Okay. Very nice.
There's no such thing as a poet that's not vulnerable. They do not exist.
So what do you write about? What are some of the predominant themes of your work?
It depends on what time in my life you catch me. Quite honestly, I write about women in general, women of color and Black women specifically, and I write about them in all the seasons of their lives and everything that the world goes through. So there have been times when I didn't write anything political pieces. There have been times when I didn't write anything self-image pieces. There have been fits from the start, too many of them to enumerate. What all I wrote were love poems. Either love poems or the other side of love poems, which is drink Clorox and die poems. There are those. There are the portrait pieces that are specific Black women at a specific time in their life and explaining how they got to be who they are and where they are and why. My collection, Lovely and Suffering, are all pandemic poems. I wrote that. I started those poems when San Diego got locked down. And I wrote the last poem exactly a year later. There's that whole switch. I hope I never have to write pandemic poems again. I hope. I'm not certain that it's not going to happen. And so if I'm too close to something, I can't write about it. So the love poems don't come while I'm in love. They come when I've had a chance to catch my breath and get a little objectivity. Okay. It's really hard to write with stars in your eyes and music going off, even when there's none there for however many hours that takes. So once you get past all of the attendant starshine and everything, then I can write the love poem. Political stuff, quite honestly, especially during the pandemic, I had to step back for a couple of days and stop crying long enough to write those. There was so much going on, and it was just all the time, 24/7. You could not get away from it. And so I had to make myself a little bit distant just for a handful of minutes to be able to write any of those. Because even the stuff that made me so unbelievably angry, I can't write in the midst of an emotion. I have to be able to step off up and back from it for at least a little while.
Stacey, please share a poem.
Okay. What kind? From what area? From what part of my life?
One with some stardust attached.
Okay, let's see. Spark. We can give you a little spark. This is one of the pandemic pieces. I no longer keep a Bible by my bed. I used to. The one I have been saved with. Fragile onion skin pages, blinding gold. I read that book from cover to cover, in Psalms by heart. And I have lived through enough to honor all of the commandments, tried not to go for broke, been tempted to see others break most. I lost King James to a flood in Louisiana. I admit it did grieve me some. My other Bibles survive. Part of my more important than my life pack, a part of my I will save you first in a fire, or as it turned out, blood. Plays by Black women. An anthology of Black poets published 1971. No fan and gold-leafed elegance there. pages torn, crumpled, folded over, marked with hair grease, quick tears, wet, and far too many memories for the voices to lie quiet on my hand. Those sisters and brothers jump off their pages and are flat out running off with them now, doubting their dreams, warning me not to get lazy or forget, warning me to do my job, lest they die. Those folks made every word my pen write or will ever, shaped exclamations of my expertise and my experience till I could write the definitions myself. They have literally survived flood and fire and famine in the form of hard times, bitter choices, and pain I could not regulate. A relationship outlasted only by the one I have with God and love and the music we survived to. They were not made to sit quiet in a pretty garden gazing at sun-dizzy petals nodding in the air. They were not meant to hold a voice still and be captive, telling me to step, stare, scream, plan, or fancy, just get it done. We came through hell and fire for you. The debt is not clear until you walk through and make it to the other side alone. I know. I do know. But this is all I have right now. Homage. Give me time to gather new strength. I will abandon the grave with flowers nodding in the heat and move to create battle-scarred pages of my own.
I need a second to process what you shared in your work. I do have a question. I want to know, does it hurt you to write poetry? If not, why not?
Yes, it does.
Talk to me. Tell me more.
Just on a very basic level, say there's a poem that's, you know, screaming at me. Okay. I know a poem is ready to write when it stops singing and starts screaming now. Let me out now. And I, in the past, not anymore, people are control freaks. Okay. And so I will like this poem when I get around to it. There was a poem that I read, and it was just like banging on the inside of my head, but I was dizzy. And I was doing some other project and I was just too tired to sit down and get it done. And I kept saying, I'll get around to it. And I started getting nosebleeds that wouldn't stop. And I started getting stomach aches that wouldn't go away. And I started getting awful headaches. It got really physical. To the point where it was scary. And I finally remember sitting down one afternoon with my nose plugged up with tissue because it was bleeding. And my head just pounding and saying, all right, and writing it down. And everything stopped. The headache went away. The nosebleed stopped. Some slept. And so I have learned, when the poem needs to be written or wants to be written, it wants to be written. Don't mess around with it. On an emotional level, yes, it is extraordinarily painful. Because it's not just the physical then. It feels like a betrayal then. And I have never done well with betrayal. Not by myself or not by other people.
So is writing a poem letting your guard down or building a wall?
Both. It's letting my guard down because I personally can't write a poem without putting everything out there on the table. Otherwise, there's no point in me doing it. It's a protection because I'm telling my truth, and the truth is always a shield. So rather than wall, it's shield. I am vulnerable and invulnerable at the same time because I am telling the truth, my truth, as competently and emotionally as, what shall I say, as honestly as I can.
Stacy, please share another poem.
Absolutely. Let's see. I don't know if you know, what it's like to feel this way. If I can make you understand this cold, dread fear holding my heart, squeezing it hard, why I can't breathe right some days. I have lived in this skin a long time. 55 years is a long time. And of course, I've been afraid. I'm human. I'm Black. I'm a woman. There is an element of fear built into all those veins. I expected to live with that price of the ticket. Fleeting discomfort. As Stevie sings, just an ordinary pain. A thing that could be assuaged or solved that would go away if I looked in the eye and forbade it take residence. There is no need to pretty it with poetic turn of phrase. Most days I am afraid or fearful or watching and suspicious. There's no fair thing to have your certainty stripped, ripped away. Listen to me. In 1963, at the 16th Street Baptist Church, four little Black girls died of being in Sunday school. I was four then. Every Sunday was rose pink dress, white gloves, and patent leather shoes, Sunday school in the church basement. That could have been me. It is not something you tell a child. My parents never spoke about it. Not in front of my sisters and me. I think because it could have been their four little Black girls. Because the horror of it was more than any parent anywhere could take. I found out about it much later, much older. I remember thinking, it will never happen again. It was never supposed to happen. Yeah. And then regime fueled by racism and hate, carrying every human filth hell ever devised, was voted in by a bunch of over-entitled, lick-spittle cowards afraid of change. I cried for 2 days after the election. And I got mad and did what I could to keep the world on proper course. I did what I know best, and I prayed. I prayed so hard. Because in spite of all and everything, I still believe, I will always believe that evil kept coming. It got easier to be ignorant, to murder under a blue line, to put babies in cages, to lie, cheat, steal, actively perpetuate evil. And I would wake up shaking sometimes. So angry. But I still woke up. I could still work. The twisting, haunted fear in my chest still had no permanent home. In 2015, at the Charleston AME Church, 9 Black folks were massacred, heads bit in prayer. They died of welcoming a stranger to worship. It was not supposed to happen again. Not in my lifetime. Not dead for being Black, taken for granted that sanctuary is safety. I was already living in shell shock with most of the world, but this was personal to me, for me. It was not supposed to happen again. 2016, evil clenched hands tight round everyone's heart. Now the Knight Riders were rapists with rich families. The sons thought they should not be punished for desecrating women's bodies under just a little action. In 2020, be Black, brown, Muslim, and breathing with an invitation to be detained, arrested, murdered with impunity. Here is abuse of LGBTQ bodies, differently abled bodies, abuse of power, babies, cages, is just another. In 2019, the Knight Riders ran the Supreme Court. And then the White House. They ran and ruined the country. And my spirit is tired. Sometimes I am so sick at heart that I cannot breathe. Cannot take the uncertainty of leaving the house and remaining unmolested for even 5 minutes. Feel as if the crosshairs of 1,000 guns are permanently trained on my back, my chest, on my throat. My heart and my words are all I have ever been able to offer the world. I take it. But one is dying by inches, and I struggle every day, every hour to make sure the other stays woke. stays honest, stays strong, stays clear a lot of days. I just can't. I'm forced to struggle making my voice do its work. Make my soul stop shaking long enough to do my work. I am forced to breathe, choking. We are forced to breathe, choking. There is no clean air in this place. Only a blood refrain that should never have been birthed. Only our killing, bitter knowledge. It could have been me. It can still. It can still be me. I wrote that during the pandemic, and I read it now because, as you and I were discussing before we went on, I'm seeing it come back. At this time of day, at this point in history, there should be no need for that poem. It shouldn't be anything but an entertainment or a reminder. And it's current, and that kills me.
So, thinking about that piece and what you've shared so far and prior to the show, what do you think your work relays about the human condition?
I hope it relays that we can't give up. I hope it relays understanding of folks who do because they don't see any other way out. I hope it relays that regardless of everything else that goes on in the world, there is still honest emotion. There is still honest love. There is still honest caring. There is still empathy. But it also recognizes the fact that sometimes it's not enough to have a shield. Sometimes you have to pick up your sword.
Stacy, I am so glad that you mentioned the word empathy. For me, it's so critically important because although our stories are different, they're also very similar. Because if I listen to you and you listen to me, through the power of poetry, in my opinion, we can build a bridge. Because there's a universal commonality in terms of our feelings and our emotions. Yes, our stories are different. Our lived experiences are different. But through focusing on the feelings, in my opinion, that helps us build a relationship. So as I've listened to you, I'd like to know, what is the relationship between your speaking voice and your written voice? Because they're both so, so very powerful.
There are some people who will tell you that they're bitterly divorced from each other, and still in trial. As far as I'm concerned, the relationship between my speaking voice and my writing voice, it's an amicable relationship. They are intertwined by the fact that they're both as honest as I can make them. My speaking voice is a little bit more, how shall I say? It knows where the nuances are. And because I've had a little, not a lot, of vocal training, I know how to manipulate it.
Okay.
My written voice, I try not to manipulate that too much because then it will come across as practiced, and I don't want that. I don't want that for either voice. The written voice is a little bit more long-winded. I get to do longer pieces.
Yes.
On the page than I do on stage. The written voice is a little bit more dependent on some of the fancier flourishes of description. In my spoken, I don't do that a lot, because then it becomes about seeing the word picture instead of listening to the way the words are moving.
Stacy, When it comes to writing a poem, who leads, you or the poem?
The poem is in control. There is absolutely no question. The poem has been known to smack me in my head and say, let's go. You have things to do. I tell my students, it's never, ever about you. Let's get rid of this myth about people creating a poem. Okay, poem is already out there. The poem is perfect and complete. You are nothing but a conduit. Okay, you're something for the poem to go through. And that's it. Well, and so the idea of any poet leading their poem, it's just hysterical to me. Because poems, much like poetry, this is not something you choose. This somebody in there, nobody wakes up and says, yeah, you know what? I'm going to be a poet. Nobody does that. Okay. Poetry comes and gets you and says, you're coming with me. This is not a choice. This is not anything that you have anything to say about. If it's meant to be, it's going to happen. Okay. But for a mere human to make that decision,
there are so many questions that I'd like to ask you, but at this time, please share another poem.
Let me do one of the newer ones. It sucks that I'm writing. You're one of the things that I'm writing. I'm about a third of the way through the new book, which is called Because the Sun Would Not Move. And so, this is one of the ones that I wrote. People say, where did that come from? And I don't know. They come when they come and they come how they come. And where this one came from, I really have no clue. Darling, you're right. I do think you're fine. Crazy, sexy, intelligent, cool, and sugar sweet. A gentleman and a scholar. I imagine in your wake lie a thousand satiated hearts and satisfied bodies. I am not that kind of girl. You're going to have to step to me different, because loving me is a revolutionary act. I should not need to, but I'll save you some time. Let me tell you exactly who I am. I am the girl who stuffs music into her ears because the glittering burn of words tumbling along the strands and threads of my DNA often leave no room for other sounds. Truth is an old, faithful lover. Integrity is my BFF. You can't live with them always hanging out. You best get stepping now. I feel no need to, but let me tell you exactly who I am. I am the girl who breathes in flame and breathes out poetry or falling stars. Never met a fantasy I could not completely enslave. Kiss me is to discover how the light in a sapphire tastes. To know how it feels to catch errant stars laughing between your fingers. To kiss me is to celebrate every woman who ever loved, never mind if it was at a loss. She loved and made herself a part of history. Love me, you must bring everything. Your wit, your sword, your sense, your shield, your strength. Be prepared to overthrow old patterns and awkward understanding, tired conventions and overfamiliar acknowledgments of what commitment should be. I don't need a dragon slayer. I got that shit. I need a dream keeper. A man to handle my body can be found with any quick look and careless smile. Can you handle my vision as well as my bad dream? I don't need you to understand me. I understand me. I don't need you to complete or save me. Do you live for that? My parents loved me enough to make me whole, and Jesus saved me when I was 12. Are you getting this? You're going to have to wrap your head around your heart, around your life, around the fact that I am not that kind of girl. The ones you're used to beguiling and being beguiled by. But bring your honor and your A-game, sugar. And let's go warrior together. Change the world with our sharply defined, luscious, all that and unique, ambitious, realized selves. you should probably stretch her. Because loving me is a revolutionary act.
Wonderful, wonderful poem. In that poem, what lines did you feel most proud of writing? Or what lines did you feel challenged you the most to write?
What line?
Yes, in that piece.
In that particular piece, that's easy. In that particular piece, Loving Me is a Revolutionary Act, that's the one that I'm most proud of, because that's the one that says everything else about the poem. Everything else is just verbiage. Okay. The hardest line. It wasn't the hardest line, but it was the most telling one, I think. I don't need a dragon slayer. I got that shit. I need a dreams keeper. That was the most telling one. I don't need to be rescued. Okay. But I do need somebody who can cradle my dreams in the palm of their hand along with theirs. The whole idea of being rescued by somebody. Unless we're talking about I'm in a burning building and I have no oxygen left and can't figure out how to drag myself to a window, then yeah, I might need to be rescued. Aside from that, not so much. That one, the biggest, the line, I don't need you to complete or save me. It's too late for that. My parents loved me enough to make me whole, and Jesus saved me when I was 12. That says everything about me. Okay. And so probably that's my favorite part of the poem, certainly.
Okay. When I listened, it made me wonder, what does it feel like to be a woman?
How long do you have? For me, it means, on a very basic level, first of all, that you have a responsibility to bring other voices, other women's voices into the whole. And I've spent a fair amount of my career doing that, actively seeking out those voices or encouraging them or teaching them or whatever way that I'm doing it. You have to nurture the craft. I can't remember where the quote came from. But I do know that there are studies that show that if you want something to grow and flourish and keep moving, you hand it over to a woman. The study said that men will use it, whatever it is you give them, use it to aid their families, their sense of what's important, their goals, their dreams, and all that. But women will share it with everybody. There's a project called, oh gosh, what is it? I cannot remember, but it was a project. It's still going on. It's a charity where you can buy like a flock of chickens or a herd of goats or an entire barnyard of animals or whatever. And they give these to women in all of these different African villages or European villages and help them sustain themselves. They have found that invariably these women use whatever profits they make, whether it's in goods and services, whether it's in actual production of something, to help other people, to other women. Okay. Nobody is keeping it to themselves and saying, I'm going to make my family grow with theirs. They're saying, okay, I got mine. I'm good. What can I do for this sister in the next village?
I'm going to challenge you a bit. You said that women nurture their poems. Okay. All right. But men nurture their poems. Okay. Okay. But men nurture their poems as well. But men nurture their craft as well. I'm going to challenge you a bit. You said that women nurture their poem.
No, I said women nurture the craft.
Okay, thank you. But men nurture their craft as well.
I'm not saying they don't.
All right.
You asked me what it meant to be a women poet. I can't speak from the male point of view. I've never been there. The whole idea, and this is why when people say there's no such thing as women's poetry and men's poetry, of course there is. I think that women are, for better or worse, socialized to be more vulnerable and socialized to put their feelings out there in front of God and everybody. We're also, I think most of us, we are not intimidated by our failure. We understand that, we understand that vulnerability is a strength, not a weakness. Tears are a strength, not a weakness. All of these are why, and any doctor will tell you, this is why women live longer than men. Because we have learned that those things that are supposed to be weak are really strengths, and we use those, we utilize those.
Stacy, all great writers, great writing influences, who are some of yours, and what makes them special and or great in your eyes?
Oh, wow. Let me answer the second part first. What makes these influences great in my eyes is that I spent the same sort of passion and commitment I have toward what it is that I do. This idea of there being something out there that is bigger and more necessary and more important than you are. That sense of just keep doing this, and what is right will happen. The people who influenced me all seem to have that spirit, that way of thinking. The list, almost all of the Harlem Renaissance poets. The really early gospel singers. When I started reading more widely, a lot of the poets came out of the East. And I think Rumi and that sort of writing. The other thing that all of these people can do, and the thing that attracts me to them as great writers, somewhere in there is a sense of magic, some sort of magic and music. Okay, the two most powerful forces in the earth, magic and music. And so I started reading Dylan Thomas. There is music in the way that he talks. And then a lot of, because who doesn't read this? Maya Angelou. And then when I fell over Toni Morrison, I lost my mind. That's pure magic. I read everything that I could get my hands on, but I am most drawn to those people, the Harlem Renaissance poets. I loved 1960s Black Revolutionary poets. I love when I found Ntozake Shange, I thought that I was home and dry. That was all I really needed. Again, that pure sense of mission and magic and music. That's what I look for. That's what's necessary for me to say, oh, this is a great poet or writer or singer. That level of honesty that you get with Stevie Wonder and Jill Scott. That pain that you can hear in Billie Holiday, because you can't do that. That's another small component. I don't want to say small, necessary component, but sometimes it goes unnoticed. There's pain in there somewhere, whether it's pain of losing something or somebody, or some part, whatever it is, some small part in there that makes you real. And that's the thing. I'm not very fond of writers who don't seem real to me. Poets, singers, whatever. And so you can be as happy as you want to. And you can be as thrilled, but there's got to be somewhere that if you're not feeling a little bit of your own pain, then show me that you can feel it for somebody else.
Yes. That's the other part of the question that I asked earlier. When I asked, does it hurt you to write poetry? The other part is, are you willing to be hurt by the poetry of others? If not, why not?
I think you're going to be. There are a handful of poets that I listen to. I walk in to their reading knowing I'm going to get my heart broken. I'm going to get my spirit gored and slashed a little bit. I can't not be there. I can't not listen to them. That level of honesty, that level of passion, that level of dedication, that level of music and magic and all the things we've been talking about is there and it's present, and it is impossible for me, and it would be immoral for me personally not listen to what it is that they're saying. Yeah, it's going to hurt. If you're doing it right, it's going to hurt. Is that a reason to run away from it? No, not at all.
Stacy, in this world, in this life, there's good, there's bad, there's ugly, as well as indifference. What do you view as being the role of a poet in modern day society?
We have to tell the truth. We have to be able to stand. There are the universal right and wrong. There are the universal things are immoral or unethical or moral and ethical. I don't really think those are all personal decisions. Whatever the truth is, according to you, tell it. That's your job. Get the word out there. That's your job. Make sure that you at least acknowledge voices that may not agree with you. But that's part of your job too. You don't have to honor them. You don't have to light a candle to them in temple, okay? But you do have to acknowledge that they're out there. First of all, because to not acknowledge that they're out there is dangerous. There's no truth that is made of 9/10 fantastic and one part. Everything is a mixture of everything. If you are a poet in this world, your job is to tell the truth. Other part of that is you cannot be afraid of what that's going to cost you. This is going to cost plenty.
Yes. Yes, it is. You
cannot be afraid of that. I had a student once who was telling me that there was this venture that he wanted to get into. And she was absolutely terrified. She'd been dreaming about it for years, but she'd never done it. And she was really scared. And I told her that the one thing that I had learned fairly early on in my career was you have to decide which is more important, your message or your fear. If your fear is more important, then you're going to have a very hard life. As a poet, you will not be able to function. So it really very much boils down to which is more important, your message or your fear.
Stacy, you speak with such wisdom. The words you share are exceptionally impactful. Here's another question that I rarely ask my guests. I'd like to know, for you, what color is poetry?
Red. Red is my favorite color, first of all. But only for important things. Okay. The things around me that I need to keep myself comfortable, to keep my head on straight, to keep me connected are all red. My favorite drinking cup is red. All of my poetry notebooks, every single one, they're all red. It's because it attracts. Okay. And it's warming. And it comes in a million different variations. And it moves. Red is a thing that moves. It does, I take it back. It doesn't just move, it dances. Okay. And so, yeah, poetry is red. Absolutely. Even at its calmness. Okay. When poetry is busy being calm, it is a nice, settled burgundy or crimson. And when it's on fire, then it's blood red or scarlet. When it's busy being silly, then it's cranberry red. So, yeah, absolutely. Red.
For some reason, I don't know why, you remind me of a simmering pot on the stove with the lid on it. But at any minute, it could explode. What do you think about what I said?
Interesting definition.
Let me explain. Red is such a fiery color. And it's your favorite color. So when I listen to your words, you champion change. But it sounds like for you that change is not coming fast enough. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, change never does. One of the things I do, is because it's part of my job, is I track conditions of women in the world. And I've been doing this for a long time. And I remember in the 70s and 80s being faintly ardent at things that were happening here anyway. But I also noticed that they were backsliding in other parts of the world. And now I'm seeing it backslide everywhere in the world. I'm seeing rights being taken away, eroded, struck down, supposedly legally. I'm seeing all of that. Just in the general worldwide view, I'm seeing things that have been in places for decades being struck down or ignored or abridged so that they no longer help people they're supposed to help or give advantage to. And I'm seeing things just get unfortunately worse for too many people in the world. And yes, of course, there are always those people and those organizations and ways of thought and those ways of moving. Yeah, they slowly, bit by bit. It's not fast enough. I'm not a patient person, first of all.
I picked it up.
Did you get that? I'm not expecting things to happen. Like I'm too realistic. Overnight, that's going to happen. Okay. Mm-hmm. But my grandniece should not be in fear of not having the same rights that I didn't have when I was her age. That's ridiculous and insulting and immoral. People now who are living through, people who have lived through seeing those changes and hailed them as, okay, we're on the right track, are now suffering from the effects of that belief. That's not okay. Not fair. What really scares me is that there are no protocols in place to combat that. Not really. Are there folks out there trying? Yes, absolutely. There are always folks out there trying. Is it happening quickly enough and being, for lack of a better phrase, ironclad enough that it actually makes a difference for my grandniece and my grandnephew and all these little kids? No, and that's not okay. Not fast enough. It's not good enough. That bothers me a lot.
I can tell. As I listen to you, I can tell that it's not enough. I hear it in your voice. I hear it in your work. There are so many more questions that I'd like to ask you. So I'd like to invite you to come back for part two. Hopefully you will come back. But at this point in this particular program, we've reached my favorite part. I view it as being a poetry lover's concert. This is an opportunity for you to share 2, 3, 4 of your works back to back, no interruption from me. Stacy, you're on the stage.
Fantastic. Wow, let's start with an oldie and work our way up. My baby's walk is a sugar glide. Prowl like a panther's move in. Easy ride. Sugar glide and honey stroll. Little girls giggle. Big girls pout the grand, bite their lip and shake their sore bones out when my baby walks. All me. When my baby walks. All me. My baby clothes fit like the sun that can fall around mountains when day is done. Pants and boots poke cut just. And the brothers glare while their girls do stare. The grands mow lawn or fluff their hair when my baby walks. Oh, me, my baby walk, on me. My baby talks like a gospel shout, that sweet talk to jazz rhythm and turned it out. Baby talks like a sinner's prayer that took an angel unaware. Little girls make eyes, big girls hang heads, and the grands say butter me some of that bread when my baby walk. On me. My baby walk on me. My baby's smart and sweet and fine on my heart and in my mind. His smile low makes the sun to shine. My knees do quake. My body aches. He ain't just my sugar. He's the whole damn cake. Love his hat. And talk and smile, he grit and grace and silk style. And my baby walks straight to me. To me, my baby walks straight to me. Oh, me. Know this. I have no investment in caring if you understand. Know this. My life mattered before you acknowledged the fact. My life mattered before you gave it your blessing. Our lives were never intended for your nod of approval. You stopped listening for your applause, affirmation, cries of solidarity. Whether we have those tools or not, we thrive. Persist. Warrior on. Your approval is the lace napkin at a barbecue. Nice, but not necessary. A good ally knows the value of silence. A fool demands attention for recognizing what has already been taught. Make your decision. Then walk where I need your field or get gone. A butterfly trembled along the edge of my finger. I will get in trouble for this poem. Because so many people are so invested in me bearing the standard of my culture and gender, including me. Convinced that my life is meant to be separate, not meant to be separate, that my strength, my resolutions are half of what holds the world together, the way and why of how I love is the other half. A Cassandra birthed by perseverance, attitude, and the lyricism of a million different promises, I do not have the luxury of saying, no, thank you. And if the battle sounds peaceful and unending, that's because it is. Sometimes I have to breathe just for me, sing just for me, and ignore the fire news from all my sister girls' battlefield. Be beautiful, be intelligent, just for me. And today, butterfly landed, trembled along the edge of my finger, and the world did not fall down, and the world did not fall down, and the world did not fall down. I know I should be hiding, praying, working. I understand what I owe my life as a Black woman. I understand the call in my blood toward gospel-stained windows and pews washed in sunlight and salvation. I know I owe my career, my life, to the women who knelt in those pews or ones like them after a day of being on their knees, feeding their children, patting their back, sides, and shoulders so that that sack of groceries did not cut and chafe, so that child had one soft place to lay down their head, so that they could relieve the ache of holding up the sky and half the world every now and again. Lord, I know there is a debt to be honored. I know. Today, a butterfly trembled along the edge of my finger, and I took a breath, and the world did not fall down, and the world did not fall down, and the world did not fall down. I should be on my knees, praying till angels' wings are broken from the exhaustion of carrying my messages. I should be marching, marching, marching in a tide of righteousness against people who will not acknowledge the rights of others or think they own other folks' decisions. I should be on stages shouting my truth, singing my hope, telling stories for the brains and hearts worldwide who are empty, aching, tired, hungry for a chance to speak. And I do, I will, I shall. Every other woman in this world, we do, we will, we shall. But some days, not many, some days, a butterfly, shivering color and light and scented of small miracles, falls gently out of the sky and explores an entire world in the palm of your hand. And between one stroke and the next, you can hear your song for just a minute, your heart beating for just a minute, your soul warming enough to take you through the day for just 1 minute. Breathe. Breathe. Breathe, sister. Breathe, warrior. Breathe, mother, daughter. Love. Accept the blessing. Just stop. Let a butterfly tremble along the edge of your finger. The children will be fed. Work get done. Your love, it will be done because it has always been done. You know this. Accept this. Stop. Breathe for just that 1 minute. Stop. Breathe for just that 1 minute. Stop. Breathe for just that 1 minute. In the world will not fall down, and the world will not fall down, and the world will not fall down. The very last word, since you asked before, a bit of fluff that I wrote a million years ago, but it makes me giggle, so what the frick, let's do it. When I say I need a chocolate fig, I ain't talking about that boy. That I'm crazy for a chocolate fig. I'm talking about some boy. I'm talking Hershey's Kisses or a full-sized Almond Joy. Now, I'm a tender woman. Love my baby through and through. I'm a tender-hearted woman. Love that man all through and through, but if that man starts acting up, then a Nestle's Crunch will do. Ladies, a Dove bar won't kiss you quick, then steal your car. No Milky Way or Snickers ever left for loose women and liquor. And let's face it, be basic. Premium Ghirardelli will never put a baby in your belly. Girlfriend, you don't cry. Musketeers won't leave you crying. And buying Tootsie Rolls by the pound may leave you broke, but they don't run around. Now, I know my man's attractive. You may make your eyes and flirt, said, I know my man's attractive. You may make your eyes and flirt, but reach out for my O. Henry bar and somebody will get hurt. When I say I need a chocolate pick, I ain't talking about that boy. And I'm crazy for a chocolate pick. I ain't talking about them boy. I'm talking Hershey's Kisses or a Bullseye. Almond Joy.
Wow. Thank you. Stacy, do you think you were destined to be a poet?
It's really easy. I can't not do this and breathe. I know for me and myself, this is as much a life force as blood or air or water. If I didn't do this, I can't even think of what that would look like. I was, the expression, called to something. And as I said before, nobody wakes up and says, heck yeah, I'm going to be a poet. Nobody in their right mind. I don't know how to not do this. Are there other things in life that I could do? Sure. I'm relatively intelligent. So and there are other things.
Maybe you've answered this next question already, but I'd like to hear the answer one more time. What do you think you learned about yourself being a poet?
It's not. Somebody asked me once, why do you do this? And the stock answer when I'm trying to be witty is because therapy is expensive and I weave lousy baskets. Okay. It's not just therapeutic. It's not just reviving. It's not just life-saving. And it is quite literally saved my life more than a few times. It has quite literally revived me. It does that on the daily. It does that hourly. It does that minute by minute. It is necessary. It is crucial to who I am in my heart, in my mind. I'm a poet, period, end of discussion. Not because I necessarily want to be, because there are days I don't want to be, but because I have to be. I don't know how to not do this and still breathe.
Wow. We've reached the end of our poetic journey, Stacy. One last question. Where do you go from here? What's next for you creatively?
Not losing my mind would be good. Yet people laugh when I say that. I don't know why. I am lucky enough, blessed enough, thank you, Jesus,
right,
to right now be running an international network of 44 of the hottest women poets on planet.
Right. Okay.
And I say that literally. We are international. The group is called Tesoro. We have members in a ton of places I have never visited. Okay. We have members all over the United States. We have members in Mexico, Colombia, Canada, England, Portugal, Australia, South Africa, England. And I'm working on taking over everywhere else one step at a time. I'm building that up. Tesoro was created so that women have a safe space, safe spaces to do what it is that we do, because there aren't enough on the ground or on the air. There just are not. And I wasn't seeing enough of being kept for us, so we are creating our own. So creatively, it's building Tesoro up to where take over the free world, pretty much. We'll let the folks that act right hang out. The rest of y'all, give your soul to God. And then that includes everything from more performances on the ground, because we were created in the middle of the pandemic. A lot of our stuff is online, but more things on the ground, more shows on the ground, workshop, down the road, educational opportunities. anything that we can do to make that mission push forward. For my own personal self creatively, I would really like to finish because the sun would not look, which hopefully will be finished before summer. And right. Then it'll be a lot of touring. I miss touring and I used to do a ton of it. Only this time when I go, it won't be bits and pieces around the United States. It will be Europe and Africa and pick a continent. Somebody said, well, you can't do Antarctica. Actually, there is a group of scientists and poets to Antarctica to do studies. The Maldives. Jennifer in the comments is saying the Maldives. Oh, yeah, babe, we're going to the Maldives. We are taking over the Maldives.
Right. I'd like to thank you being my very first guest on this new venture. You are literally a force to be reckoned with. And your poetry as well is a force that needs to be heard. The passion, the conviction, the music, the magic, the emotion, as you said earlier. I am so glad that our paths crossed. And with this being Women's History Month, Stacy Artis Dyson, you are a phenomenal woman, a phenomenal poet. And I want to thank you for being with me. It makes it very special.
Thank you so much.
Stacy, I'd like to thank you for being my first guest on this new venture. You are literally a force to be reckoned with, and your poetry needs to be heard and studied all over the globe. The passion, the conviction, the music, the magic, the emotion. I am so glad that our paths crossed. And with this being Women's History Month, Stacy Artis Dyson, you are a phenomenal woman, a phenomenal poet, a phenomenal human being. I enjoy this episode so much. I wish you nothing but continued success.
All right.
This has been an absolute blast. Thank you, Michael.
Right.
Still craving poetry? Hundreds of episodes of the Quintessential Listening Poetry online radio and YouTube podcast are available to listen to or download on iTunes, Spotify, and other streaming platforms. To learn more about the popular podcast or how to become a guest, visit www.quintessentialistening.com.